This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am your host, Chris Spangle, and joining me via Skype is the only parent in the Wallaverse, Joe Ruiz. Joe, how are you doing?
Good. That makes me sound like the old man in the Wallaverse, but that's not actually true. That's actually you.
Of the regulars, which essentially now is down to Creighton, Greg, you, myself, now that Peffers, which Creighton has flip-flopped with Peffers. Peffers is out in California. Chris, I always invite on, but he never makes it. And then Gina is off floating somewhere, although I invited her to come back to the show this coming week. And I don't know if we're going to put this as a standalone episode or fold it into the standard Thursday night, Friday episode. But yeah, of the regulars that are still with us, and obviously Maya is always irregular, you are the only married person, and you are the only person with kids out of that group. I, of course, am no longer married. Greg has done his best to avoid anything resembling marriage, and both of us have done everything we can to avoid kids. So, and Creighton, who knows? Who knows what lays in store for the prom king and prom queen of liberty?
Yes.
So we'll see. But there's a story that came up, and so I wanted to talk to you because there's a story that came up over the last week, and it's a movement called Free Range Children. And I know that you've done some homework, but honestly, few stories have pissed me off as much as this story. And I wanted to get your perspective on it. And so to set it up, I'm going to go to Silver Spring, Maryland, and this is WUSA 9 in the Washington, D.C. area of Maryland. I think that's where Silver Springs is. And a couple, what is their name? Oh, boy. Okay.
I think it's pronounced Mietiv.
Yeah. How about we play this, and they'll tell us how to say the name, because I'm sure that they have a pronunciation of the name in here. So okay. Here we go. Let's go live to tape to Maryland.
Brief statement from Montgomery County Child Protective Services today did little to calm the shockwave surrounding an incident with two local children taken into custody last night. The 6 and 10-year-olds have gained worldwide notoriety because their parents allow them to be free range, which means they can walk together around their neighborhood without an adult. Andrea McCarron broke this story, and she joins us this evening from Silver Spring.
I can't believe we're going through this again.
An emotional Danielle Mateev late last night after her two children were finally returned to her by Child Protective Services.
Well, the policeman said we'll give you a ride home when we were like 2 blocks away. So we got into the car, and then about 2.5 hours later, instead he brought us here.
10-year-old Rafi and 6-year-old Devorah had been playing at the Silver Spring Park and were walking home. But at 4:55 p.m., police received a call asking officers to check on the children's welfare.
Somebody called 911, the police called CPS, and they decided to bring the kids here, and they didn't call us.
CPS finally called the Métis 3 hours later when they were frantically searching for their missing children.
You've got to tell the parents. I mean, especially if it's one of those things where the parents are being accused of not paying attention to where their kids are without giving them any sort of notice, I think is unconscionable.
Parents may disagree on when it's safe to let children walk unaccompanied.
6, definitely not. 10, with a group, maybe.
But after this incident, many question the priorities of Child Protective Services.
And I just hope that, you know, the authorities are also, you know, not using all the resources just on this case, and that they're looking at other children as well who may need more care and assistance. Now, the CPS statement says protecting children is the agency's number one priority in that it is required to follow up on all calls. CPS officials say they can't comment any further because of privacy laws. Now, we have a breaking development. Our colleague, Garrett Hake, just obtained the 911 call made by that concerned citizen who was witnessing the Métis children walking down the street to their home, which is right down there, right around the corner, less than a mile from the park where they were playing. We're going to have much more on that 911 call coming up tonight at 6. Until then, reporting live from Silver Spring, Andrea McCarron, WUSA 9.
Yeah, a lot of people want to know what's on that.
All right, so I had not heard that. I didn't know how it actually started. So how did they pronounce it? Métiv?
They said Métiv.
Métivs. So the Métiv parents allow their two children who look, you know, like your standard issue 6 and 10-year-old, and I know that when I was 10, I started babysitting. I don't know if I was 10, maybe 11-ish, I think is the age when I started babysitting my sister, who's 2 years younger, and my brother, who's 6 years younger, because all I had to do was, if there was an issue, call the neighbor down the street, who knew our names, who were really close, or the neighbors across the street, or the neighbors next door. We had three or four neighbors that we were close to, or call my parents, or call 911 if it was bad enough. And my parents felt comfortable leaving us alone with me in charge at 10 or 11 years old. And so this kid is walking with his 6-year-old sister down to the park less than a mile away, and some no-good do-gooder, some no-good do-gooder decides instead of, you know, calling out of their window, "Hey, kids, are you okay? What are you doing?" And actual having human contact with the children, decided to call the police at 4:58. 2 minutes later, they dispatch a call. An officer arrives within 3 minutes. He finds the children. So this is pretty impressive. The call goes out at 4:58, and 5:03, the police officer is there. So
it makes you think they live in a safe neighborhood, right?
Yeah, I mean, a 5-minute response time is really impressive. So that was one of the first things that I noticed about this timeline. Mm-hmm. The officer then at 5:16 contacts CPS. He doesn't take the kids home. I mean, presumably, if they are walking from their house to the park, they know how to get back, so they know where they live.
Yeah.
And by all accounts, the children were terrified throughout this whole ordeal, because basically a police officer came and kidnapped them. Mm-hmm. And then an hour later, so the officer contacts at 5:16. At 6:10, officer contacts another CPS employee. So an hour goes by, and CPS doesn't respond, doesn't get back to him, doesn't do anything. So he calls a second time to Child Protective Services. At 6:41, an hour and a half, 90 minutes, the original CPS worker contacts the officers and says a decision is still forthcoming on the children. and then at 7:18, 2 hours afterwards, they decide to transport the children to Rockville, which is a town nearby Silver Springs, take them to a different place. 7:43, the officer and the children arrive. The parents are not contacted until well after this at 8 p.m. Mm-hmm. And the parents are freaking out because they are, and we'll talk about if they're responsible parents. I obviously think they're perfectly responsible parents for letting, you know, their kids go down the street, but I'm not a parent. So that's why we have Joe here. Before we get into what you do with your kids and talking about your family and what you do, mm-hmm. is there any way there isn't any way to describe this other than this is the state kidnapping two children?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the best way that you can possibly word it. And I've got a lot of things that I could say about the system, if you will, having worked in it for about 7 years. I've seen some of the worst examples of the state being irresponsible. And this is just, I mean, something to add to the list.
I mean, this is really, you know, from the officer, it goes back to episode 91. And if you've not listened to episode 91, Rachel's story, from every point of contact that these kids and these parents have with the system is not acting with any kind of common sense. The officer doesn't contact the parents. You know, and apparently this is the second time that they've been abducted by CPS. You know, and Child Protective Services here in Indiana, at least, and you probably with your past work history know more. I mean, CPS takes your kids, and you really have very little recourse. It all comes down to what a family court judge ultimately decides. But they take your kids; your kids are gone.
You know, and
it's up to one person. You know, and there are instances in my life where I've had friends who have gone to family court with horrendous situations, and the judge doesn't ever read what is before them. They just make a ruling because they've got to clear this off their docket, mm-hmm. and the child is not cared for, and the best actions are not taken by the court.
Are you able to call an Amber Alert on the government?
No, because that's a government. We are taught as kids, police officers are good. If you need help, go to the police officer. The police officer will help you.
We struggle with that in my house, by the way.
Yeah, because obviously this officer, I obviously don't know his name, don't know him personally, and I'm not going to sit here and say that this police officer is a bad police officer and that this police officer is, you know, not looking out for the best interest of the kids, because the most likely scenario is that the police officer is doing what the system has set up for him. So he doesn't have, you know, if he wants to keep his job, he's got to follow these certain protocols when it comes to this situation, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he is taking them back, contacting CPS. He's diligent about it. You know, he's just trying to make sure the kids are safe. Now we can get into a greater libertarian argument, which is he doing what is moral and ethical? His job is maybe not moral or ethical when he is not contacting parents and not serving the public by not getting in contact with the parents right away and say, hey, what the hell are you doing? Your kids are out loose.
Oh, you're going to have some libertarians that are like, oh, by the very nature of the police officer's job, it's not moral or ethical. But, I mean, just working with what we're dealing with, you know, he's obviously got a certain list of responsibilities that he has to work within. And you know, I would say that kidnapping children is probably not one of them.
Sure. Now, it's easy to look back at this and say that that's what this officer is doing. But,
right. can I just give you a little bit of background on my experience with the system?
Please.
I mean, I've seen some things, man. I should probably start by saying, yes, I am the parent of two small children. Our daughter is 6 years old. Her name is Cameron. My son, 3 years old. His name is Jensen. And
Adorable children. They take completely after their mother, not their
completely,
father.
Completely. But, I mean, if you look at the two sides of this, I mean, there's the question of, you know, on the one side, like the parents who were involved, they obviously wholeheartedly believe in this idea of free-range parenting, which is a new term to me. And then the other side is the state. It's the CPS. It's the very nanny-like, overburdensome system, which has seen the worst. And then so it aims to protect from the worst and ultimately, in my opinion, then becomes the worst. In that process, and I spent about 7 years in a youth corrections type environment, and that's before I left social services altogether. I've dealt with CPS, I've dealt with the state, and Chris, if you were to ask me straight up, like, do you trust the judgment of the people who work within this system? I mean, it would be a very simple no, and I'll give you a great example of it. This is the story that always kind of haunts me. It always comes to my mind. Yeah, one of the units at my former job, it housed boys ages 15 through 18, and they were locked up primarily because they were, you know, what society would deem thugs. And what I mean by that is they got in fights, they skipped school, they did drugs, they stole from businesses, and in some cases, some of them even had committed rape. Because they were minors at the time that they did those things, they weren't put in prison. They were sent to us in hopes that taking them out of their environment having them participate in groups and therapy would rehabilitate them. And, you know, they would be better people when they were then re-released into the wild. And, dude, that sounds so optimistic and it sounds so great. And part of me wants to believe still to this day that it would work and that it could work if the one thing that hinders it from working a majority of the time, the state, would just be removed from the equation. And I say that because we had one boy. I won't say his name. He was 17. And even in the confines of the program, we set some pretty strict parameters for those boys. He stole from his peers. He organized riots. I mean, I was sent to the ER probably at least on one occasion. Had a chair broken over my head, a wooden chair, a heavy-duty chair. It was used to being thrown into brick walls and not breaking. Broke over my head.
Well, that's because you're thick-headed, Joe.
Exactly.
Sorry, I couldn't let that go by. I had to, you know.
But, I mean, he swung at adults, and eventually, though, after a while, though, he did start to come around. He did start to absorb the things that were being said to him in this program. And then you enter the state. There came a point where they started to see that he was making improvements. And what I mean by started to see is that a caseworker would talk to his therapist, and they would get a report. And then that caseworker would go to a DCS worker and they would talk to the family. And so there's all these middlemen. And then, so like on an individual level, social workers are these bleeding hearts. They care about kids and families. They want to help. But then you add in budgets, you add in regulations, you add this mountain of red tape, and you create the system that it hurts more than it helps. In this case, they said, oh, it looks like he's getting better. So we're just going to send him home. And I mean, it was a red flag to all of us. You know, our staff, the therapists, the people that worked with him on a day-to-day basis, they said, starting to get better. Hold on a second. Starting to get better, but he's not there yet. At this point, you throw him back into his home with the same family, with the same neighborhood, he's going to fall right back into the same patterns. We're with him every day, and we would really strongly advise against sending him home at this point. And the state just says, well, you know, we're not spending any more money on keeping him here. It's been long enough. They sent him home. Months later, it was in the newspaper. His family fell in hard times. They were starving. They didn't have any money to buy food. His criminal instincts kicked in. He wanted to survive. He wanted to protect his family. I don't know. They didn't have any money to buy food, and he ordered a pizza to be delivered at this abandoned house down the street from their address. He walked down, and the delivery guy showed up. When he showed up, kid takes the pizza and shoots the delivery guy. At this point, he was 18, so he was tried as an adult, put into prison for murder. The state was so worried about its budget that they were willing to rip him out of this program before he was ready to be pulled out, before, you know, and now the taxpayers are going to pay for the rest of his life to keep him in prison, and a person had to die. I mean, it's so counterproductive. If you're going to force a kid into a situation like that and make him confront the issues and the bad programming that he's had for so many years, man, you better make sure you finish it, because these are the kind of things that can happen when you don't follow through.
Yeah, and that is truly the downfall of trusting the government. I mean, these programs are not created, you know, I've been around these people forever. These programs are not created to intentionally hurt people. They're created with the best of intentions. You know, because you read these stories, or you see these families, or you have advocates coming and talking to people, or, you know, you have the social worker bleeding heart who wants to use the government for good. But the problem is that while human beings creating the government and human beings working within the government, while they have the best of intentions, the nature of the state limits their potential to do that. To do that good because of budgets. And I just defy anybody to really look through. There was a time where I wanted to say, man, I'm for low taxes because I think less taxes are going to create more revenue. And I am for using the government to create better family outcomes because a strong family will not produce that kind of result like you just described. Let's call him John, okay? Yeah. And in John's case, that's not going to happen if his family is, you know, doing well financially, blah, blah, blah. Ignoring human nature and that not everybody's going to do well and not everybody's going to do poorly and that, you know, living that black and white existence. And I was a Republican. And then you become a libertarian and you start to really think about what human nature entails. And at the end of the day, everybody, it's all about incentives, as Greg always says. Mm-hmm. What are the outcomes? What are the incentives? If this system is devised, then what are the incentives for the individual? Because we're no longer thinking on, as Republicans and Democrats do, they think on a communal scale, they think in groups, and libertarians think in individual terms. How will this affect the individual? And when you have a social worker working for CPS, they're going to be less productive than someone who works at a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And back me up, but just based on my anecdotal experience working with people that work for the government, doing the charitable work of government in situations like CPS, mm-hmm. there really isn't an incentive for them to work harder. And often they are enthusiastic in the beginning, but then that enthusiasm wanes when they realize that they have very little power and little resources to do good for the individuals that they are trying to help.
And that's why there's such a huge burnout rate in social services. I mean, people get in and they think they're going to save the world, and it doesn't take long for them to realize that their hands are tied. And you could have all the best intentions, like you said, but
and conversely, if you're working in a nonprofit that is not connected to government funds, and I've seen this with Rupert's Kids, mm-hmm. you have unlimited potential when it comes to budgets and capital, because you can go out and fundraise. Your budgets are set by, you know, governance and various standards and checks and balances that you put in just to make sure that there isn't any fraud or anything like that going on in an organization. But if you set your budget at, let's say you're $1 million a year charity and someone donates $3 million, well, then you can go back and adjust your budget. You don't have to go back to the legislature and go through the political process and convince all these completely out of touch, wrong-headed Republicans that control the majority here in Indiana that helping people through DCS is good or help and so on and so forth. You are tying the good work of that individual to politics, and that's just not realistic. And so libertarians advocate for welfare, but private welfare, you know, and so social services being brought under the private nonprofit banner, because fundamentally, you know, I think that people are fundamentally, I don't want to say good, but when we see someone in need, we want to respond to that need. We right. want to help people in need. And especially here in America, we have that sensibility that when we see somebody who is struggling, when we see somebody in need, we want to help them. That's how CPS and all these other welfare programs, maybe not a welfare program, but social service program, that's how they begin is, well, somebody's got to do something.
Yeah,
and the problem is that as we as individuals say, well, somebody's got to do something, but I'm not going to do it because I'm too busy. You know, I'm not going to volunteer. I give enough money to taxes, so I'm not going to donate to charity. And so we now find ourselves in a weird situation where the government is starting to assume all the responsibility but can't keep up because it can't get enough budgetary resources to fulfill the needs. And it's strangling our desire and willingness to donate to charities, and so charities don't have enough. And so if we went with a fully privately funded nonprofit system, I think you'd have a better shot at helping people like like John, the person you mentored.
Yeah, because I know that there were definitely some, you know, and most of the employees there, they really wanted to see him continue to grow, him continue to, you know, get over some of the things that he had, you know, to overcome from his past. And the fact that it all came down to dollars and cents was just kind of mind-boggling. And that's, if you have a completely private practice and you accept clients and you accept referrals, you know, for based on different circumstances, then you have an unlimited potential to share experiences and to work with a person in a way that could potentially heal them if both parties are interested. When you start to introduce CPS, DCS, any of these little, you know, departments in the state, you know, then, you know, hey, do you want to take this kid? Can you bed him? Can you put him? I don't mean bed in a nasty way. Can you give him a bed in your facility? And if the answer is yes, we have room for him, then all of a sudden you're not private practice anymore. Now the state is in bed with you. Now you have sort of strings attached to your obligation to this kid. And so, you know, it becomes very dirty, very quick. And I agree with you. And I think most libertarians would.
Because how many people around you go? Yeah. How many people around John that you knew of, you know, a lot of people, you have a larger network. You would have helped raise money for John. You could have put up an Indiegogo or crowdfunded some sort of start
for him. There were a few people who worked in that place that actually stuck around, who were there just for a job. A majority of the people who started there, they wanted to help. They actually had a sincere and genuine love and passion for helping people, for helping kids, and they wanted to see those kids do better and be put into a better situation. The most exhausting thing was, you know, for all the times that we were cussed at or punched at or spit at, you know, had things thrown at us or whatever, had doors slammed in our faces, for every time that those things happened, it was not nearly as exhausting as the feeling of, you know, all the litigious stuff that went on behind the scenes with how departments had to change and, you know, how things had to be scheduled and the paperwork that had to be done. And you spent so much time on the red tape that you had very little time to really commit to those relationships and making them everything that they could be. And I understand that the government has to safeguard against certain lawsuits and stuff, but that's really only helpful if you're being helpful. And when you're creating situations like the situation with John, then all your paperwork is just useless.
Yeah, and I've seen it with Rupert's kids. Rupert has a charity that does something very similar. Obviously, the survivor guy that ran for governor in 2012 on the Libertarian Party of Indiana ticket, great friend of mine, and we are libertarians. We have maybe if you go to wearelibertarians.com and look at the Chris Spangle Show link there, and I think I have an interview with Rupert about his program. Mm-hmm. Two new podcasts on the front page of wearelibertarians.com, by the way. In the middle of this deep discussion, let's insert a plug, Joe. And Rupert does not take any government funding. Now, he obviously works with the government. He works, right now he's moved his whole program to Shelbyville, and he has become an economic development force in Shelbyville without taking taxpayer money. He's taking properties that are on that are basically off the tax rolls in Shelbyville, that are abandoned properties. He's taking those over and flipping those and selling those, and is using young men and women who are getting out of the criminal justice system, where Rupert's kids is kind of a last stop. So if you are getting out of a juvenile detention facility, you're somewhere between 16 and 25, and you've gone through all the other programs and you failed, you go to Rupert. And Rupert puts you to work, and he's a very, very tough boss and looks after these guys. And not only does he put them to work and give them a job and start building a sense of empowerment, at the same time, they're helping a small, struggling community here in East Central Indiana. And making houses that were abandoned and not, you know, not being useful and were being used as drug den houses. Now he's turning them into, you know, homes that benefit the community. Using
and the kids are learning and the awesome kids are job learning. Skills, man, that they wouldn't have otherwise had, right?
Absolutely. And because he's Rupert and he works hard to put them into other roles and transition them out into other work, and also at the same time teaches them how to manage a bank account. Because as you can imagine, a lot of these kids come from backgrounds that are less than optimal, and teaches them life skills, just basic life skills.
And that, man, you don't know how much we would have loved to have something like that at the place where I worked. I remember we would try to do things that would empower kids and make them feel like they were doing something productive and helping people. But there were so many big rocks in our way. Like we thought, because the cafeteria on campus threw away so much food, I mean, good food, they would make just gobs of food every day for every meal, three times a day plus two snacks for these kids. And a lot of it would just get thrown away and wasted at the end of the day. And so we said, well, why don't we let these kids, you know, the ones who are, you know, doing the best in these programs, why don't we allow them to take this food over to the homeless shelter and make it a donation? You know, that way it kind of serves the purpose of, you know, feeding the homeless, but it also at the same time serves the purpose of building these kids up and making them feel like they're doing something good for their community. And we were told that we couldn't do it because, you know, the food was already cooked. It was unregulated. You know, by the time we got it over there, it had been in an unstable temperature. It might grow bacteria. There's all these different things that were being considered that were more important than
feeding,
you know,
people,
homeless people actually eating.
Yeah. So, and it is a huge, yeah. My brother actually worked just down the street from Wheeler Mission and when he was going to chef school. Mm-hmm. And the students at the Chef's Academy where he went to culinary school, you know, all they did was just make food in a professional kitchen that was licensed by the state all day long, way more food than they could ever eat in mass quantities, you know, because they're taking catering classes. Mm-hmm. And they tried to strike a deal with Wheeler Mission, and Wheeler was like, we have to go through all these licensing processes, and then you have to do this. And at the end of the day, they're probably just going to deny it. So we're just not even going to look into it. We've been offered this so many times. Thanks, but no thanks. And it just didn't work out. So big, beautiful cardinal just landed in the cherry blossom tree right out in front of me. So I'm amazed I got through that whole little speech without the keys dangling in front of my eyes.
Is that a squirrel monk?
Just, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I my entire life, Joe, I don't need a wife. I'll say that. But I need maybe a butler. Somebody who just, you know, goes around and jangles the keys in front of me when I'm distracted because everything takes so long. You've been around me long enough where I'm like, we need to go do this. We need to take this in this direction. And you and Greg just go, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And then knowing that I'll eventually just go, no, that was a bad idea. Let's just stick with what we're doing here.
That's actually really funny because I find myself to be the most ADD guy in the wall thread,
oh,
I guess.
God,
it's like, I should do this. I should do this.
No, I am personally.
Why should I vote?
I mean, it took me probably an hour longer to do my daily tasks today for really no reason, just because I just woke up that way. You know, so and I've tried Concerta, but that just made me angry, man. Yeah. ADD medication is basically amphetamines, and I just was an angry dude. But anyways, and so we got onto this.
This big thing, but
you know what? And screw the lady from this story who didn't walk. I'm just gonna say that she's probably. I have caricaturized her as an 80-year-old, very obese, horrifyingly ugly, awful woman. Because that's the only explanation, that she is a monster and might scare children if she walks out of her house and walks up to two children to ask if they're okay. I mean, the only explanation for not being a decent human being and walking out of your house and seeing if those kids are okay,
right,
is that you're going to scare them, and they're going to run away from you out into traffic and get run over by a car. I mean, that's there. Lady who I know, the lady who listened, she's probably a fan of We Libertarians. Let's be honest.
Who isn't?
you should go play in traffic because this is not how neighbors behave. You know, it isn't that hard. If you're that concerned about the kids, why call the police? Impressive response time in 5 minutes. Seriously. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm impressed with that.
Well, we should talk about the free range philosophy a little bit, though, because that kind of took me aback a little bit.
So the parents, here's the mandatory part where we say when we were kids, it was different, Joe. Now, I'm 31. I think you're what, 29, 30?
30.
I grew up in Plainfield, Indiana. It's a suburb of Indianapolis. It's beautiful. It's a great place to live. I had a great education. I have a lot of great friends. If Greg were here, he went there as well. He'd agree with me. Mm-hmm. Just fantastic childhood. Great place to live. Very middle class, you know, very white, suburban, middle class upbringing. Rode my bike all over town. When I was 9, 10, when I was this young boy's age, I would get on my bicycle and I'd ride it all the way across town, 2 or 3 miles away to the baseball card shop or to the bookstore or to the Marsh grocery store to buy, you know, candy bars and then hide them under my mattress.
Wow.
I've always been a fat kid.
Was Andy Griffith on the police force?
No, you know, we had your standard police force, but there wasn't really crime. We didn't have, it was similar in many, many ways to Silver Spring, Maryland, knowing a little bit about that community.
Yeah.
And I would just get home from school and my parents would be at work and I would just get on my bike and go and they wouldn't know where I was. I just knew that I had to come home. And then if I didn't show up by a certain time, they would probably start looking for me. In high school, I would go down and hang out with friends in Martinsville. I'd leave Friday and say, Mom, take it off, going to Martinsville, see you Sunday. My mom didn't know how to get a hold of me. She finally got me a cell phone. But my mom trusted me that I would make good decisions, and I never, ever got into trouble. Obviously, I've never drank, I've never done drugs, you know, tried to have sex, but that didn't work out. You know, so I was always a very trustworthy kid, and so were my brother and sister. You know, so the idea that a 10-year-old kid and his 6-year-old sister can't do what my sister and I did when we were 10 and 6, which is go across the neighborhood to the community pool and to the community creek and woods by herself. You know, one Thanksgiving day, we walked 2 miles to the creek, played there, walked back. Is that just not done today? I have a few friends in the school system, and they have to, at work, we were talking about this at work, a couple parents were going to go on a field trip with the kids, and it was like to the museum or whatever, and the parents have to have background checks now. You got to have background checks to do anything, to even go into the school to have lunch with your kid.
Oh, yeah.
You have to have a background check now.
So here's the thing is it depends, you know, whether or not a parent should allow their kids to roam freely, whether it's a half mile down the house or, you know, the next town over or whatever. It is really dependent on whether or not the parent is able to discern something about their own child. Nobody knows the child better than the parent of said child.
Except the DCS, the police officer, the governor, and the president,
which is
right?
Why those little factions suck and shouldn't be involved in a situation like this at all, you know? I mean, because, like, you know, you grew up and you had that ideal Mayberry-esque situation.
We had family problems and my parents eventually got divorced. It wasn't totally idyllic, but...
Hey, Opie.
But yeah, I mean, we were able to... We had a nice enough life that we could play, okay? It wasn't hardship.
And mine wasn't terrible either. However, I have since moved from LaPorte, and LaPorte today is now wrought with heroin problems and all sorts of different stuff that wasn't around back then.
As I like to call it, the armpit of Indiana.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, but I've moved over to South Bend since then. And literally, I tell you that one day I was sitting at a red light. And not running it, which is uncharacteristic, but I was behind another car. And I saw that's a joke. I saw a person, an elderly woman, standing at the bus stop waiting for a bus, and she was holding a giant handbag. And the car in front of me a kid jumped out, grabbed the bag out of the old woman's hands, jumped back in the passenger side of this car, and then they sped off. The world does seem to be very different than it used to be when I was young. At the same time, it's different from area to area. So to have any sort of blanket agency naming, you know, like, oh, this area is unsafe for your child to roam freely or something like that, is kind of silly. The parents have to know where they live. They have to know who they live around. They have to know what kind of decisions their kids make and are capable of making based on the relationship that they have with them. And if they feel comfortable enough to let them go outside, then, hey, man, that's cool. You know, like my kids, though, I'm probably, having worked in social services and having seen the absolute worst situations that could arise from kids being left to their own devices, I probably wouldn't let my kids do those kinds of things at age 10. Maybe when they're a little older.
Yeah, but let me argue with you. You and Mickey are great parents. You know,
right.
And I'm just going to go out on a limb, not knowing anything about any of the children you're describing that you've worked with. If you end up in a situation like John, where you're at the home where you worked, you probably didn't have the strongest set of parents, or you have serious mental issues that need to be treated that went untreated because your parents were lax.
Right. Well, not everybody has those kinds of parents.
Yeah, but
things that you got to watch out for.
So, my parents were great parents and instilled in us a sense of independence and good decision-making, I guess, and exercised a little bit of freedom for us to make good and bad choices. For instance, I could take off on my bike and I could ride wherever I wanted to, and I could go across town and I was safe. And, you know, I could have gotten snatched, but I didn't. I mean, I remember being a kid, fourth or fifth grade, walking to elementary school, and then that stopped for about a month because there was a van around Brentwood Elementary that was suspicious, and there were reports, right. And so my parents took us to, but the community, the neighborhood, we all knew each other. The parents all got together and talked, and the neighborhood association, years before we had gotten there, had built a pool, and that kind of built, you know, my parents' friends during that time period were people that were neighbors. And all the neighbor kids, my sister's best friends that to this day are kids that she met in the neighborhood. And so word would get around like, hey, there's a van with free candy painted on the side of it. Maybe take your kids to school for the next month until the police kind of dealt with the situation. But at the same time, my parents, you know, trusted me with a little bit of freedom, even as young as 10, to do things like go to the library. Which was half a mile away, maybe, on my bike, knowing that I was smart enough and that they had done a good enough job that I'm not going to ride my bike 5 miles. Because if I get out, you know, too far, then I'm not going to be able to get back, and I'm going to be hosed, and I'm going to be in trouble. And you just kind of knew. And with all due respect, you and Mickey are definitely those type of parents where it is, you know, your kids are, hopefully, only having met them once, going to have that sense of boundaries. So,
I hope so too. But again, you know, having worked in the industry we worked in, we've seen such bad situations that we don't trust, you know, other factions in society.
True.
You know, there's this
can accept.
Yeah. I mean, like I, one of the kids that I worked with at one point, you know, great parents, great family. They were well off financially. You know, she had a really good head on her shoulders. She asked her parents one night if she could stay the night at a friend's house. She stayed the night at the friend's house because her parents trusted her to do that. That night, she was sleeping on the couch, and one of the kid's siblings came out and molested her while she was there. And she didn't tell anyone until she was a grown-up because she was afraid. And, you know, then she had all sorts of issues going through therapy and stuff because she just didn't want to talk about it because it was such a traumatic experience for her. So, I mean, those kind of things, like, you know, regardless of your upbringing, can happen. So you have to be conscious of other people as well as a parent, you know, and the bad things can happen. That's not to say that you should. All right. So, like, going back to the reason story about the Métis kids, right? This whole story was written by this Lenore Skenazy. She's like a blogger at Reason, and she also does this blog called Free Range Parenting, which I checked out prior to the podcast in order to do a little bit of research. And one of the things, she was talking to Nick Gillespie about how there's this mentality that, you know, everyone should be afraid of everything, pretty much. And one of the reasons that I didn't like her free-range parenting concept is because she took it to an extreme where she was saying it's not just the kid who's walking to the park a half a mile down the block. It is, you know, a parent left their kid in the car for 10 minutes or something by themselves while she went into a store, you know, and she's like, well, this guy came in and he was panicking because there was a kid left in the car by himself. And he says, do you know what kind of bad things could happen? And her response was, well, do you know the probability of that? And do you know the kind of bad things that could not happen? So, like, they're taking it to that logical degree where they're saying because it's possible that bad things won't happen, they feel secure even knowing that there is a possibility that bad things could happen. Now, as a parent, I'm saying that if the possibility exists that something bad is going to happen to my kid, you know, in which there's a statistical probability in everything that you do that something bad could happen. But I'm not going to look for those little moments where I'm going to say, yeah, something bad could happen and then put them in that situation, you know, unless I feel really, really, really comfortable. And so she kind of took it to the extreme that you can use that logic in all situations where, you know, even if the possibility is there that something bad could happen, the fact that there's a possibility that something bad won't happen too means, yeah, just go ahead and do it, you know?
Well, there's probability and there's possibility. I mean, is there is it a possibility that Rick Santorum can be the next president of the United States?
Absolutely.
Yes. Is it probable? No.
Yeah.
And so where do you, as a parent, draw that line where, and maybe it's a case-by-case thing in your gut.
That's what I'm saying, is it is a case-by-case thing
yeah.
in all situations, which is why, you know, if I haven't been clear enough, which is why DCS and CPS needs to butt out of those situations. In a case-by-case situation with all parents and their relationships with their children, things have to be examined. You can't exercise anything from a blanket level when it comes to parenting. Every situation is very, very different.
So maybe I'm not totally clear on the free-range children. I mean, was I a free-range child based
sure.
on that description? Just because...
Yeah.
What
they're doing is putting a label on it, but it's, you know, the idea that, you know, kids should be given space. Well, what they say...
See, when we were kids...
They have a right to space. They have a right to space, and they
right.
have a right to privacy, and the parents have a right to give them that space. Now, I kind of halfway agree with that. I think a parent has the right to give their children whatever space they feel comfortable with, but until they're of a certain age, I would not say that that kid has any sort of right to... you know, walking down to the park on his or own, everything until they're out of the custody or the care of that parent is at the parent's discretion.
Sure. I mean, there's a strain of libertarian thinking that views children as property. That they inherently, that they're people and they have in certain rights, but at the end of the day, until a certain age, they're property of their parents.
I don't like the word property, but I mean, I do. Is, you know, they are. It is our job as parents to protect them and to teach them up until, you know, a time when we feel comfortable with them going out and making those decisions on their own. But you know, she talks that Lenore Skenazy. She talks a lot about, you know, this fearing everything, which to me goes back to. There's an old theory called cultivation theory. And it was kind of, I guess, proposed by this University of Pennsylvania professor named George Gerbner. And he basically, it was called like the mean world syndrome. Have you ever heard of the mean world syndrome?
No.
Okay, so it's basically this social theory that says people watch all these bad things that happen on TV, whether it's the, you know, the violence on an on-screen drama or in film or on the nightly news. And because they see it so much, even if they tell themselves, it's not real, it's just TV, you know, with the exception of the news, your brain can't actually turn off the thought that maybe there's a shred of reality to that. And because you pick up on maybe there's a shred of reality to that, you are more likely to think that the real world is like that, that it reflects the real world and that the bad things that happen on TV happen in the real world. So over time, according to Gerbner's proposal or his theory, society, and then you introduce social media, so it's no longer just television, but it's gangster rap, it's social media, where we see the constant posts about police brutality and abused children and things that people like to post on Facebook and wherever. we get the idea in our head that it's a bad and it is a mean world out there. And so the people who are free-range parents are rebelling against that thought. They're saying it's not a mean world. They're saying what you said earlier about the system. It's that people are inherently good if given the opportunity to be so. But I think that you have to find a happy medium. I guess is what it all comes down to, in my opinion. As a parent, keep your kids close, keep them safe to the best of your ability, you know, as long as you can. They're not going to be with you forever, but while they're in your care, I mean, just cherish every little second that you can and make sure that nothing bad happens to them. On the other hand, it's not the state's responsibility to discern for parents where their kids are and are not able to go.
Well, obviously, your kids are younger, but your daughter's sort of getting to an age where she doesn't need you there all the time watching her every move.
No, and she can be in her bedroom or in the living room, you know, while I'm in my bedroom or while I'm taking a shower or something like that. But she's not going to be out playing in the yard while I'm taking a shower.
Sure.
Is the difference. And that's, you know, and maybe some free-range parents would think that was okay for the six-year-old to go out and play in the yard. We live in an apartment complex. It's not fenced in. There's other people walking around. I wouldn't allow her to do that. But maybe some people would. That's, you know, my prerogative as a parent would be to keep her where I am most comfortable mentally having her while I'm doing something like taking a shower or whatever.
Sure. So let's say you're just sitting there watching TV and she's maybe a year older.
Seven?
Yeah, 7, 8 years old. Are you going to let her go out then? I mean, so, and I'm not picking apart, I'm just kind of curious as to, you know, what are the boundaries? Are we at a point, and this is really kind of my question, are we at a point where, you know, when we were kids, the term helicopter parents was starting to creep into modern vocabulary. The idea that a parent is always hovering over a child and that there's never any space, even into adulthood. I mean, fortunately, I don't have this anywhere that I work, but, you know, 22-year-old people, their mom coming to taking them to work and talking to their boss and helping fight some of their battles. That's the extreme of the helicopter parents. And most of the parents that I know now are, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, are helicopter parents, where their kids are never outside of their sight and really, you know, not even, there's just not much space. They're always together. You know, so when and where does that balance between free range and helicopter sort of come in? Because, you know, at six, I could definitely see how you still want to make sure that they're always within earshot, always within eyesight. You know, always around, because our friend Ryan Ripley once described children. He had two little boys, and he said, "Spangle, what you need to know about parenting is that you have two small children that are, imagine that you have someone on amphetamines trying to commit suicide 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it is your job to stop them from killing themselves."
Yeah. For a while, it's true.
Yeah. And fortunately, your daughter's kind of moving out of that and is becoming more independent. And so at what point do you watch TV and she goes outside and plays? I mean, is there a point?
In a year or so, she might be able to go outside by herself, and like where I can still see her, though, is the thing. I don't remember really like going down the street and playing outside of my parents' eyesight until I was, or at least outside of a parent's eyesight until I was 10. But just because that was right for me at age 10 doesn't necessarily mean that it'll be right for my daughter at age 10. You know, like it just depends on the kid, the level of trust that you have, the level of rapport that you have, you know, and whether or not you feel like they can take on that responsibility. There might be a kid who's ready for that at 8. There might be a kid that's not ready for that until they're 12. You know, it just depends on who the kid is and what they're all about. My daughter's going through a phase right now where she likes to tell lies and she likes to keep secrets, and she's only 6. Would I let her go out and do something at this point? Like, no, because, I mean, I have a little bit of a trust situation with her right now.
Sure. Play this podcast back for her. Young lady, Listen to your mother and father. That is enough of this.
Yes.
Dear Leader commands it.
There was a girl in 1993 named Raina Risen. She lived like a half mile down from where I lived in La Porte. And she was out with friends one night, and then she just never came home. And her body ended up surfacing in a swamp right down the road from my house. And they did not solve that case until
now,
like last year.
Anything you'd like to admit, Joe?
No, they finally solved it. It was a cold case for like 20 years, and they didn't solve it until 2013.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And so, like, there's, like, the whole... It's like you have to be conscious of this. Yes, there's, like, the cultivation theory where you have to be like, oh, well, just because it happens on TV, just because I see it on the news doesn't mean that's what's, you know, probably going to happen in real life. But on the other side of it is like, well, these things really, really do happen.
Sure.
You know, in real life. And just because it's not likely doesn't mean that you might be the unlucky person that everybody else gets to watch on TV. I had a buddy that used to say, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean that everybody's not out to get me. You know, and there's like this shred of truth to that where it's like, so as a parent, you become a little bit more paranoid if you're a good parent, I would imagine. It doesn't mean that you, like I would kind of take offense to the whole helicopter parent title because, you know, there's an extent to which you just want to make sure that you're keeping them safe. You love this person, this little person from the day they were born. You're investing all of your time and love and energy and money into this little person. And as they're growing up, your number one priority is to keep them safe. You know, are there extremes that that can be taken to? I would imagine that there are, but I would say that it is always better to love that kid a little too much and take care of that kid and keep them safe a little too much than it is to be neglectful. I don't think the parents, by the way, in this Reason story were at all neglectful. And I think the cops and the CPS people were completely wrong. But I think there is a fine line, and I think that parents need to maintain a healthy balance and keep their kid protected and under a watchful eye.
Well, and I think for these two parents, they felt comfortable with the distance, with the situation, with the neighborhood, with their children. It's not like they are sitting there saying, you know, we're gonna troll society and send our 3-year-old kids. I mean, they obviously what is right for them is not right for you. And so at the end of the day, what right do you and I have to say, no, you can't do that? Because
judging by the police response time, it was a pretty decent neighborhood. Like we said, when I sat on jury duty recently, I mean, the cops in South Bend, they like live on the west side of South Bend. Like they are always there because that's where the stuff goes down. And when the case that I sat in on the jury for happened, it took them 20 minutes to probably get somewhere that was only 5 minutes away.
Right.
Because they're always there. And so, like, and you know that's a bad neighborhood. They get called so much that they're like, oh, here we go again. And they're just kind of like, whatever. In this situation, like you said, creepy, monstrous old woman calls. And 5 minutes later, there's a police officer at the park to check on these kids. That's got to be a pretty nice little place to live.
Yeah. I think there's truth to... I think we are a more paranoid society. And I do think a lot of it has to do with the total lack of journalism by most local TV news stations. And we've talked about this on the show report. Check this feed for past episodes where we talk about journalism. You know, if it bleeds, it leads is what gets ratings. And secondly, it's so much easier to report on criminal justice issues because there's police reports. You know, if you're dealing in politics and you're doing political reporting, you're dealing with he said, she said, and you've got to go to multiple places, get multiple sources. There's a lot of secrecy in politics, so it's kind of hard to do that kind of reporting and be totally accurate in what you're reporting. And that's why you see a lot of political commentary, but you don't necessarily see a lot of political reporting a lot of times. So that's why I don't even know
what that is anymore.
Yeah, you've got Politico, The Hill, Roll Call. That's political reporting. But then you've got this glut, including this program, of political commentators, you know, where we read the political reporting and then commentate on it and fill it in with our own conjecture and biases. But local TV news stations, so they don't do political reporting because people don't want to watch politics. They want to hear about the latest crime or abduction. And it's easy because there's police reports and you can verify the facts because they come from the state government or the state agency or the local police department, and there's witnesses usually, and it just fits together in a nice, neat little package. And then you have those links amplified through social media, and you have the people that you trust the most saying, oh my gosh, isn't this world the worst? You know, you get on, and your aunt and your uncle and your brother and your sister and the people that you love and trust the most are saying what a terrible place the world is, and you're made up, you're made up of the five people that are closest to you. Mm-hmm. And if they are negative and paranoid about the world, you might be as well. But at the same time, I totally understand what you're saying. I mean, I've got a niece who I love dearly, and if I were babysitting her, I wouldn't let her out of my sight because I couldn't bear letting down my family, letting her down. Anything, right. If anything happened to her, I would be, I wouldn't be able to live, you know?
I would cease and amplify that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like all day, every day.
Right. I couldn't live with myself with something. So I understand the impulse. Trust me, I do. Yeah.
You know, another thing that I would say in closing, that the good thing about having a partner that you're living with when you are raising a child together is that you are able to validate your concerns when you have concerns about what they should and should not be doing, and also give the opposing view. You know what I mean? Like, there's been times where my wife has been like, you know, totally comfortable with Cameron going to do something, and I've been like not comfortable with it at all. And then there's been times where I was comfortable with something and she wasn't comfortable with it at all. And, you know, in the situations where it's obviously a bad idea, both of us will know that it's obviously a bad idea. But in a situation where there's a little bit of debate, it's so nice to have that person next to you to give you, I guess, the other side of things to kind of temper any sort of, you know, paranoia or concerns.
Thanks, Joe.
So,
I'm just kidding. My life is so much better.
I'm staring at a meme of you with breasts right now on Fox News.
We're up to like almost 70 people in that Facebook group. There's a secret Facebook group if you're not in the know. Send us a message or scroll through the past posts on the We Are Libertarians Facebook page. But got a secret group where, you know, 70 people are kind of chatting and, you know, sharing news stories and helping us people weigh in on some of this. And I think the most common question in that was, how do we fight back against CPS? How do we fight back against a system that can take our kids, and we have, you know, the government can kidnap your children and you've got no recourse and we just allow it? Why don't you, I mean, how do we fight that, Joe?
Like, all right, so like on the one hand, there's no, you know, they've got the guns and, you know, more of the guns, I guess I should say, than we do. There's not a way to fight them physically. Politics is like one way, but it's long and it's drawn out and it's an uphill battle. If you're someone who is, you know, liberty-minded or for more freedom, we see that all the time. We Are Libertarians or Libertarian Party or Liberty Republicans or whatever. But, you know, the thing that we can do, in my opinion, is continue to do what we've been doing, which is make a big stink out of it on social media and on Twitter. Tell the media what you think. And be careful about your tact, because there are people who are just a-holes on social media, and I don't feel like they ever change anyone's mind. But, you know, for us to point out how obviously ridiculous it is that an agency like CPS would take these kids to a town over and kidnap them for a period of a few hours while the kids are frightened, rather than just calling their parents to check on them and make sure that they know where they're at. I mean, to just point out how ridiculous that is in other situations like this, I think that's the best thing we can do, is just to laugh at it and say, really? Like, because, you know, that's how you shape public opinion, and then public opinion eventually, hopefully, shapes legislation.
Yeah, I think just in the way that I mentioned how we built the climate of fear, you start rolling it back by sharing what is and is not acceptable. And I think, you know, obviously, who are we? You know, who is Joe Ruiz and Chris Spangle to have a podcast and a website and tell people what they think and expect that people should listen? But we have managed to find an audience, and we did this with, you know, it cost me money, and I'm fine with that because it's a fun hobby, and I get to, you know, hang out with friends like Joe and talk to have an excuse to talk to a friend like Joe that I ordinarily wouldn't, and people listen into the conversation and are informed as to what we believe society should and should not do. And what they should
ordinarily hang out with me. Why? Because I'm Puerto Rican?
Because I don't, you know, you're from out of town and it makes me uncomfortable. And no, it's because you live in South Bend and I don't like to do things.
Yeah.
So no, but
it's a joke, by the way.
I know. So but we have just decided that, listen, this group of us, we've got an opinion and we want to share it, so let's just put up a website and start doing it. Mm-hmm. And we go on our social media and we share what we think is or is not appropriate for what society ought to do and what the government ought to do and not to do. And you're going to get people that disagree with that, and then you're going to get people that are mean to you in comments or mean to your aunt. You know, this happens to us all the time. Post something on our personal Facebook page. It's an opinion. The regular group of political common, you know, the armchair political quarterbacks who we're friends with that we always discuss politics will start commenting. And then a normie, a regular person from our life, like an aunt or an uncle or a sister, will comment or a friend from high school and say, blah, 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 blah. And then all the political people will be like, "You're an idiot. Shut up. You're so uneducated." You know, and then you feel bad because, like, you invited somebody to your house and they insulted you.
Yeah,
but that's the cost of doing business. And I think the way
something about our social media, you guys have had like so many opportunities recently on the shows to comment on our Facebook followers.
Yeah, let's do that after I finish this point.
Okay,
I will give you your you will shine. So, you know, I think you've just got to put your opinion out there. You've got to find these stories. Or you've got to find these stories and share your opinion. You've got to take this podcast and say, listen, I know this is an hour and a half long, but it's entertaining and I like this show and they make a lot of really good points. And where's your limit at? Ask your friends on your Facebook questions, your Twitter friends, whatever your social network is. Ask people in person when you're with them at soccer games. Or, hell, get to know your neighbors. You know, I live in an apartment. Joe lives in an apartment. I've become, in the year I've lived here, I've traded phone numbers with the girl upstairs. I know the names of the, shut up, Joe. I know the two people across the hall. I know the police officer down the street. I've made connections with probably 10 of my neighbors. I don't know how to contact all of them, but they're aware of me. We're familiar with each other. We say hi when I'm outside and they're outside walking their pets or whatever. You know, get to know your neighbors. And just like I had when I was a kid, you know, monstrous old Betty is going to call you or is going to say to the neighbors or feel comfortable talking to the kids if we have interpersonal connections. And I think sharing your opinion, getting to know the people around you physically, and sharing your opinions and kind of values, those are two things that help. Because at the end of the day, listen, voting does what voting does. I'm not going to say it's the most effective means, but I think the most effective way that we have to change society is to share opinions on society and be unafraid in doing so. And taking stories like this and kind of surrounding them, what's happened is a social media firestorm. And every entity these days has a social media outlet. And if they get 40 tweets saying you did a stupid thing, they're all going to kind of reconsider policies so this won't happen again in the future. They probably got more like 40,000 tweets, and so they're really they feel like, oh man, the police department, the local CPS divisions, when you have public outrages like this, we can say how we hate these manufactured crises and these political outrages, but that's how change is made. Again, by sharing your opinion, being unafraid in doing so, and making your voice heard and demanding that things are changed. So I want to get your opinion before we go here on Rand and also the social media, so some of the stuff we've been talking, because it's rare that we get to kind of get together. We just had a rare time when we were both free, so, and I wanted to talk to a parent because, it's like having, it's like talking about women's issues if you're not a woman, or talking about military issues if you're not in the military. You're not allowed to have an opinion on anything relating and rearing children if you are not a parent. So I needed you for credibility.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, it would only make sense. You want to talk about parenthood, ask a parent.
Yeah. So your opinion on our Facebook. I admit I may have been a little harsh. I take things a little too personally. I get passionate, and I say things on Facebook to people that probably listen to the show, and I regret it, and I always go back and delete it after the damage has been done. Sometimes they're asking for it, Joe.
I agree, and Creighton he cracked me up in his rant on the last and on the Why You Should Support Rand Paul podcast, because, you know, in like one breath, he was like, and they're idiots. Our Facebook followers are idiots. We love our Facebook fans, but they're idiots. And he like said that all in the same like sentence, and it made me kind of chuckle to myself. It's like, I don't want to say that about everybody. It's, you know, but at the same time, there are people who, they don't seem to understand the We Are Libertarians brand as we built it. When we've put on our logo in the past, the phrase, all the irreverence that modern politics deserves, we let you know immediately we are going to approach politics from, I mean, while we have serious discussions on the podcast, we're going to joke about and we're going to make light about it, and it's not going to be taken very seriously. And yes, on the Facebook page, like within the confines of that page, which, you know, Facebook owns, but we own it, I guess, secondarily, but we're going to make fun, and we're going to, you know, even semi-troll at some points, because just some of the things that happen in the political arena are just silly and stupid and worth joking about. And people still are like, well, it's not very nice of you to denigrate the candidates. And it's like, bro, you know, I said to this guy the other night, because I posted a picture of Marco Rubio with Mickey Mouse ears, and I said it was, you know, the exclusive We Are Libertarians campaign poster that the Rubio campaign had given us that they hadn't given to anyone else yet. And he's a Florida senator, so I gave him Mickey Mouse ears, and I said that his campaign slogan was, let's make America the most magical place on earth. It made me chuckle. One guy was like, you shouldn't denigrate the candidates like that. And I'm like, no, like, that's what this page is about. Like, the politicians who step up deserve all the denigration that they can possibly take, because if you want to be king, you deserve to have your robes rustled a little bit.
Well, and we don't, you know, there was, I'm thinking of one specific meme that Greg created of Rick Santorum that Greg posted.
It was hilarious.
And if you'd like to see that, join the secret Facebook group, and maybe we'll have Greg share it. But, you know, we have limits, and I don't think that we ever do or say or post anything that we wouldn't say to somebody's face, because that's sort of my standard in living. Like, I just don't ever want to say something about somebody, and of course I fail at this, but I don't want to say something that I'm not going to say to somebody's face. Now, I don't have a lot of problems saying a lot of stuff to people's faces, which is why I have so many friends, Joe. but, you know, we try to bring some levity to it, and sometimes it's only funny to us, and we get that, but, You know, we try to find some humor in all this because
you have to.
Yeah, we take it seriously and we do the podcast, but at the same time, it's kind of like if you can't, it's not saying that we're Charlie Hebdo or The Onion, but we certainly do post a lot of The Onion because in that humor, there is a lot of truth. And there are a lot of things to learn and different perspectives that humor can bring. Hell, my day job is my real job that I get, you know, actual money for, is working for the arguably the largest, best, greatest nationally syndicated comedy radio show in history, the Bob and Tom Show, where we have a ton of comedians coming through all the time, and we write comedy bits and we put out comedy albums and. You know, my job is packaging all that for the internet. And that's just part of who I am, is goofing off.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing is, there's like two kinds of libertarians. Until an actual libertarian utopia is present in our former, or in our government, I guess, or in our society, there's two kinds of libertarians. There's like the bitter, grumpy old libertarian who... you know, rages against the machine and spends his entire life pissed off in his basement on the computer. And there's like the libertarians like us who just kind of can laugh about everything and ridicule everything because we just see how ridiculous it is, but we don't want to be the angry guy.
Yeah, I'm sort of the first one.
You're sort of the first one? Yeah. I'm definitely the second one.
Yeah, definitely. and Creighton, for whatever reason, had said something that we had kind of said for like two or three episodes in a row. But he touched a nerve, and our friend Oria Torres was like, I'm just going to go post on Facebook right now just to spite Creighton. Who the hell does he think he is? Not a verbatim quote, but, you know.
Creighton did a really good job of articulating his arguments in that episode. I mean, he's just so dang passionate about Rand Paul. That Rand boner really gets me pumped up, and I don't even like.
He is a Rand boner pump, that is for sure.
Like, so regarding Rand Paul, just like. Creighton may have convinced me in listening to that episode. He may have. But my thing is just simply, at the end of the day, it's not about, is he a real libertarian? Is he just messaging? Is it, you know, like all that stuff is up to interpretation. And you have to watch with a very careful eye. My thing is just don't be in like I'd imagine that Creighton's kind of like all in on Rand. I don't know, like, you can't be that all in on any politicians because politicians disappoint you so much all the time. The entire history of elected officials, you know, there are disappointments. And so, like, you know, I don't want to put this guy up on a pedestal. Like, Ron Paul was a cult of personality, but he never became president. My guess is if he would have became president, he would have done something that pissed libertarians off.
And he would have had to have been the most authoritarian president of all time to do what they would have wanted.
Right.
And I see a lot of correlation between Barack Obama and Rand Paul in that Obama's folks were true believers. They weren't the Clinton pragmatists. They were the young ideologues. And Obama, I think, is an ideologue himself. And I've maintained this most of his presidency. There just comes a point when you look at this guy and say, listen, he thought he could get in and be different than the machine.
Right.
And the machine had already made choices for him that he couldn't change. And when he realized that he wasn't going to be this grand and effective president, he lost interest in the job and is kind of a feckless, ineffective leader.
You know what scares me most about...
I don't think that Rand has that sort of level of delusion. I think he's a very practical person, much less ideological and more pragmatic than his dad. But I do think he's going to be a letdown for if he gets elected. I think there's a lot of libertarians that are going to be totally let down by this guy because there are certain choices that will have been made for him that he's not going to be able to end or stop or roll back. And he's going to have one or two big policy things that he can do. And that's going to kind of be it, and then they're going to get disinfected, disillusioned, and wander off like Obama's
again,
folks
have. The next great white hope comes along.
Right.
You know, and that's what scares me the most about Rand Paul, is despite liking a lot of the things, a lot of the ways that he's voted, what scares me the most about a guy like Rand Paul is like Ronald Reagan, who is like put on this pedestal as the greatest icon that a conservative could have ever had as president or ever did have. And he had all these great libertarian things to say in his speeches and some of his rhetoric. Government is not the solution. It's time to check and reverse the growth of government. Like, he said all these things that were very, like, you know, should get libertarians shaking their fist in the air in support. But dude asked for so much foreign aid money. The Congress wasn't even willing to spend the foreign aid money that he asked for. Mm-hmm. He pushed through like $8 billion to increase the U.S. contribution to the IMF. You know, he like tripled the actual, as far as what he spent, he like tripled the gross federal debt,
right,
from like $900 billion to, you know, over $2 trillion. You know, and so like he was this guy who had all this like really great libertarian rhetoric, but he grew government significantly, like more than the two dudes who came before him. And what's wild about that is he is put in this like Mount Rushmore type scenario where all these conservatives look up to him the way that they do. And like for years, they've just been waiting for that next Ronald Reagan to come along. And so as a libertarian, what freaks me out about that the most is that when a person comes in and says things and does a really great job of speaking and clarifying his positions, you know, regardless of whether he lives up to it or not, to me, all it does is, you know, well, all right, let me take a step back. Even if Rand Paul was elected and he was like the greatest libertarian president that ever existed and he did a freaking phenomenal job at being president and all libertarians were like, woohoo, Rand Paul. Like, at the end of the day, all he's really done for a majority of the uninformed public is like reestablished people's faith in government and what government is able to do. And like, in order to be really effective as a libertarian, in my opinion, Rand Paul would need to be the kind of president that's saying, this is what I'm doing, but just so you know, this shit isn't working because of me. This shit is working because we're removing government and anybody could come up here and do the exact same thing if given the opportunity. And the fact that you didn't give them the same opportunity for the last however many decades is on you.
Yeah, and I think I get the sense that he's a fairly humble person, and I don't think that it's about him. And I do think that he would totally...
He'll really verbalize it. Because people will, sure, make it about him whether or not he makes it about,
yeah,
him.
Good. And those are great points. You know, he definitely is going to become a cult of personality like his dad, which immediately means that I will dislike him. you know, and what I just can't stand is not necessarily the politicians themselves, but I actually went back and listened to the first few of the episodes of We Are Libertarians, like 1 through 3 or 4, and the Ron Paul candidacy was still going on in 2012 at that point. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly still listenable. I was really dreading those first episodes, but they kind of sound similar in pace and tone and action to the newer ones. But and it was super weird to hear Jeremiah Hodgkin on the podcast in episode 2. Now Maya Axton. But at that time, you had all these Ron Paul folks who just couldn't give it up and say that it was, you know, they couldn't admit that it was over, that there was, you know, they could go to the convention and there'd be a floor fight when, you know, clearly, I remember arguing with Galt in one of those episodes. It's like, no, dude, it's over. Just accept that Gary Johnson is the guy that you should vote for. No. We're going to change it from the inside. You know, and... I'm not going to deny that Ron Paul had tremendous effect on growing the libertarian movement because
this is my libertarian training wheels.
Sure, me too, and because he was in the Republican debates, and he just made sense, and he was an ineffective and not a charismatic speaker. Rand is much better at that, but. I have a problem with followers, I guess, more than the actual people themselves, because we're going to get into this situation where people follow these politicians and their guy is the one that's going to save it, even if the guy is closest to us as possible. It's like, you know, don't unfriend me on Facebook because I don't support Rand Paul, or don't unfriend me on Facebook and call me names because I don't support Hillary Clinton, or because I support Gary Johnson. I mean, we're going to get into that inner family squabble soon, and that's the stuff that I hate. It's like, if you're taking politics so seriously that you're defriending people and hating other people because they're just not doing what you want them to do with their vote, that kind of makes you a control freak. That's not what we're about. You want, you know, Rush Limbaugh just got dropped from the WIBC signal here in Indianapolis, which is kind of the beginning of the end for Rush. And we'll talk more about that Thursday with Greg, because Greg's been on suicide watch. but, you know, good.
I looked at that.
It's like,
on suicide watch.
Good. Get rid of Rush Limbaugh. He shouldn't be on radio. It's like, no, Rush Limbaugh should be able to be on radio. People should be able to listen to him. Like, it's not Rush Limbaugh, the messenger, that's the problem. It's the people hearing it and just taking verbatim what he says that are the problem. You know, why I as a libertarian, am never going to argue for shutting down another avenue, another voice, another person, even if they're communists. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody has a right to speak and put their voice out there, and that's what Gary Johnson's going to be doing. That's what Rand Paul's doing. That's what Jeb Bush is doing, Hillary Clinton. And good for them. We should have more people. We should have 50 people in a debate, for all I care.
You brought up Galt, and I have to plug in, since you were talking about prior episodes, that we had a comment on Twitter from a guy recently who had gone through our entire catalog and was in the process of listening from start to finish. And he said, guys, I just listened to episode 23. I got to tell you, that was pretty rough, and I might stop listening if they're all like that.
Yeah.
So I was like, huh, and I went back to the archive, and I downloaded episode 23, and it was The Fight.
Yeah.
And it was such a terrible episode.
Was it?
Just in comparison to some of the better ones we've had, yeah, I listened to it, and it was, Creighton and Galt were shouting over each other for, like, the last 30 minutes of the podcast, just, and, you know, people hearing this are going to want to go back and listen to it now. They're shouting over each other, and
could you hear me?
You can tell about to get hot, and it's just like a feeling, and you're laughing.
Yeah, can you hear me giggling the whole time? I was giggling like you wouldn't believe. It just was so, like, I don't know. It just was entertaining, because I never thought it would actually come to fisticuffs, and then what happened afterwards, and you're breaking up a little bit, Joe. I can't hear you.
Sorry. This is how it sounded. It sounded like this. Creighton would be like, and you're an idiot for thinking the fact that we need to talk about conspiracies that devolves, it just does nothing for the credibility of this movement. And Galt's like, no, you're wrong. You're wrong. And it was like that for 20 minutes, the two of them just shouting over each other. I was like, good God, this is no wonder the guy had such a hard time listening to it. These, you know, but at the same time, they were so damn impassioned.
I know.
They couldn't even get past it. What are you going to do in a situation like that?
That is one of the things that I love about Galt and Creighton both, is that they're so passionate. But I mean, it was clear after that episode that, like, man, there's going to be a choice at some point, and one of them forced a choice. But you know, it was always nice to have that level of passion, because I can't really say that, like, I love this stuff, I love this podcast, I love the people that we have, like, the community that we've built, and I love, like, getting to know, you know, listeners and talking to them. You know, we joke a lot about it, but I truly do. And I'm like, it blows me away that 3,000 people download this thing.
Yeah. You know? Well, like, it's because everybody serves their purpose so well, in my opinion. You know,
yeah.
Like, passion's one thing, but, you know, like, somebody's got to let the singers to the singing to the singers, and somebody's got to Ryan Seacrest that shit. And you do a great job of it.
Yeah. And, like, I'm a good host, and I'm not necessarily all that passionate. I'm always been more of a moderate type personality and news, you know, and Greg is very studious and is sort of the same way. Galt and Creighton and Maya bring an aspect of, like, just they just kick it up a notch.
Yeah,
you know? And sometimes that's not for everybody.
Yeah.
But I think we've done a little bit, you know, who knows, the nothing in life stays the same. But we have unbelievably managed to keep everybody mostly involved for a long period of time.
Yeah.
Which is good. So,
yeah. I love it.
All right. Well, I need to go take a nap, because it is 4:30.
I don't even know what that is. But real quick, I want to ask the question, since we were on responsible parenting and all that, like how much hovering is a good thing, to anybody who is on our Facebook page, who may be listening to this podcast, or anybody that's on Twitter. Like, I'm curious as a parent, what other parents are doing, you know? So, like, how much rope do you give, you know? How much rope do you feel comfortable giving of the things that I said on the show? You know, how much do you relate to? How much do you dispute? Like, I'm kind of interested in that kind of feedback, since we had a conversation that can be so broad depending on the different personalities that are parenting. So I'd really like to hear back from some people in our social media.
Yeah, I noticed that in the Facebook group that we had a lot of parents going, what does everybody else think? I know what I think, but I kind of want to make sure I'm not crazy. And maybe that's like what parenting is just like you have these thoughts and you do these things and then you go, am I crazy?
It's so crazy, like how you can sit around and theorize what kind of parent you'd be, and then when you're like sleep deprived and in the thick of it, like just life just changes all of it, and it becomes so instinct and in the moment, and very little about how you theorized being over the years.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. So yeah, Joe's going to put up something, and parents, get on there and share your thoughts. And Joe, I will hopefully have this up tonight.
It's going to be a full podcast now that it's gone an hour and a half, I'd imagine.
Yeah. I'm not going to splice all this together and give people a four-hour podcast, because Greg has been MIA for like a week and a half, and you know he's going to have a ton to say about everything. So we should also mention Hillary Clinton got in the race, Marco Rubio got in the race. So we'll talk about some of that stuff. We are, for those of you who have made it to this point, just to let you know, we're getting back into the swing of it. We have committed every Thursday night, 6 o'clock, we're getting together, we're doing the podcast, like that's just what it's going to be, mainly imposing that restriction on me so I can't flake out or,
oversleep.
Well, I never oversleep or anything. Excuse me. I just belched. But
that's Ben Swan.
Yeah. Shut it. All right, so let's give you a chance to wrap up. I've got mine, and maybe we share it, but something special this weekend happened to We Are Libertarians, and that's what I'm going to end with.
Go ahead, because I'm curious about what you're talking about.
Well, you go first, because I've got to end the show.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Woods.
Yes.
Yeah, so Tom Woods was at a Young Americans for Liberty conference giving a speech, correct? And he was talking about resources or things that people should check out and listen to, and he mentioned the We Are Libertarians podcast.
Our friend James Mayer, a local libertarian, had gone out to the YALCon in Ohio, where Woods was speaking, I think it was like 49 or 50 liberty topics in 50 minutes, and said, you know, hey, use your commute time to learn about this stuff. Don't just, you know, waste your time on music. Learn stuff. And a couple great resources are, obviously, you want to listen to my podcast, The Tom Woods Show, which everybody go thank him and subscribe to that right now. Or anything from Ludwig von Mises or We Are Libertarians. That's a great podcast. Check that out. And, like, I was pretty happy.
Of all the podcasts that he could have said that about to include us, I mean, what an honor.
I know.
What a cool guy.
Yeah. I mean, that was really awesome. And if Tom Woods is listening to this, we want to thank him for that. Really made our weekend. And thank you for recommending us. It's not just that it's Tom Woods recommending us. It's that anybody is recommending us. it means a lot. I mean, you have to understand, when you just kind of say, hey, I'm going to put this podcast out there. I'm going to make this thing and put it out there, let people judge it, and I hope people like it. To have people like something that you make enough to go in front of college students and say, hey, these guys make this thing, this is good, go check it out, that's a huge honor for us. And it's even better that it comes from Tom Woods, somebody that we all look up to and respect. And so really huge, huge honor. And if you're listening to this, Tom Woods, thank you very, very much. And our appearance in your podcast feed has done more to raise our listenership than anything else we've done, I think. So thank you for both. We greatly appreciate it. So, Joe, anything you want to finish with?
I'm good. Let's close it up.
All right. Until Thursday, we promise to do better Thursday, I guess. Is that how we're going to go? All right. Thanks for listening to We Are Libertarians. Joe, thank you for joining us. And we will see you soon. Go to WeAreLibertarians.com. Check out all the new stuff that we're building there. I've spent all weekend working on the website. Look at it now. There will be a pop quiz on Thursday. See you later. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.